zeroed in on the sheet steel. The lead agent at the site pointed them toward a red outcrop. They went that way, squatted down, peering through a clump of weeds, and Gomez drew his pistol. "Easy," Virgil breathed. Stryker eased up next to them and said, whispering, "We could hear them talking. Must be really tight in there." They waited 20 minutes. The lead agent said once on the radio to Gomez, "Patience, patience, they're right there." And Gomez repeated it to Virgil and Stryker. 20 minutes, and then the sheet of metal twitched, and then a man's head and shoulders pushed from beneath it. He pulled out a long weapon, looked like another M16. He knelt for a moment, catching his breath, then turned and snaked up the bank that he'd just emerged from, looking down toward the farmstead. He watched for a second, then slipped back down the slope and pushed the sheet up, said something, and then fur came out of the ground, sat up, gasping for air, looked around. The two talked for a few seconds, then fur pointed up the hill, and they both stood, crouching, weapons hung low in their hands. And then the lead agent shouted, "Freeze! DEA! Put your hands over your head!" Both men froze. Then Fur shouted, "Virgil!" Virgil yelled, "You're good, George. Just drop the weapons." Fur spotted the direction of his voice, yanked the M16 up. Stryker cut him down, and the rest of the DEA guns tore the two men to pieces. Beside him, Gomez had gotten to his knees and emptied his pistol at the two. "Jesus," Virgil said. "Oh, Jesus, stop, man." They walked down. Fur and the man he'd called John, Virgil supposed, were 6 feet outside the end of the culvert, lying on their backs. They'd been hit 40 or 50 times. Their weapons were converted M15s. Fur didn't look peaceful. He looked like a dead weasel. John didn't look like anything. His face was gone. One of the armored agents said to Gomez, "They resisted. It was straight up." "We did it straight up." Gomez nodded. "Straight up," he said. "The motherfuckers."
Chapter 20. A duck-billed wrecking machine plucked splintered lumber out of the wreckage of the farmhouse, like a steel velociraptor. The sun was rolling down below the horizon, the sky as orange as a bluebird's belly. Virgil sat in the open door of the barn's hayloft, feet dangling, eating a bologna sandwich provided by the taxpayers, two other agents chewing along with him, talking about the fight, when Gomez walked up on the ground and called, "Let's go to town. TV is waiting."
"Fuck you," Virgil called back. "I knew you'd say that. I talked to Davenport, and he says he wants to see your happy face on all channels, thanking the governor for this opportunity to take crime fighting into the sticks."
"Fuck Davenport," Virgil said. "Get your ass down here. I'm too tired to fool around."
Gomez walked away, stopped to talk to Stryker. Virgil stood up, dusted off the seat of his pants, picked up a half-drunk bottle of Pepsi, and stepped toward the ladder down. One of the agents, the Latino-looking New Yorker who'd given Virgil a hard time about his T-shirt, said,
"Virgil, we owe you. Putting those guys in the truck and taking them out of the yard, we pay. You ever need help on anything, you call us. No bullshit."
The other agent nodded, said through a mouthful of Wonder Bread and bologna,
"Anything."
Gomez and Stryker rode to Bluestem with Virgil in the shot-up Ford, trailed by two more agents in one of the North Crew trucks. They'd both been back and forth since the killing of Fur. The two badly wounded DEA agents were still alive. One would probably make it, the other probably not. Two more, whom Virgil didn't know, were less seriously wounded, and almost everybody was scratched and pitted by rocks, dust, and pieces of metal. Pirelli was screwed up, but not terminally. A slug had busted up his shoulder joint, and putting that back together would be tough. His broken arm was another problem, and would take a while to heal.
"And Judd," Stryker said, "where's that asshole?"
A DEA arrest team had gone after Judd
as the raid on the farm was taking place, but hadn't been able to find him. His car was at his office, the door was unlocked, but there was no sign of Judd.
"This bothers me," Virgil said.
"Why would he be gone?"
"Tipped?"
Gomez asked.
"By who? One of your guys?"
"When Pirelli called me, Jim and I were together, and we were together every inch of the way. Neither one of us called anyone."
Stryker nodded.
Gomez said, "Maybe, I don't know."
Gomez asked, "You got a better shirt than that?"
"And another jacket," Virgil said. "We can stop at the motel."
"Keep the jacket. I don't want you guys washed up," Gomez said. "I want you looking messed up. But the t-shirt is too much. Looks crazy, given all the dead people."
"I got a black AC/DC shirt that should be perfect," Virgil said.
"Virgil."
"I take care of myself," Virgil said. "Stop worrying about it." They stopped for 2 minutes at the motel. Virgil pulled on a plain olive drab t-shirt that gave him a vaguely military look, and Gomez said, "Not bad."
Stryker said, "Hell of a day."
He had three little pockmarks on his left cheek, showing blood. He wasn't cleaning that up either. A DEA information specialist had flown in from the Twin Cities and set up the press conference at the courthouse, the same room where Virgil and Stryker had been after the killing of the Schmitz. More media this time, a half dozen trucks, including freelance network feeds going up from satellite trucks parked in the courthouse yard. Too late for the evening news, but the late news would get it, the cable channels, and the morning network shows. Gomez led the way, gave a terse 5-minute briefing, using the satellite photo of the farm, an outline of the fight, starting with the attack of the dogs, compressed the time a bit between the first shots at the dogs and the fire from the house, and ending with the shootings of Fur and the man they still called John. He showed off a gas can full of glass tubes of methamphetamine, and allowed the best-looking media lady to handle one of them, holding it up to the lights for the cameras. While she was doing it, Virgil noticed Joan and Jesse at the back of the room, looking at him and Stryker with deep skepticism. They were standing next to Williamson, who turned repeatedly to Jesse, talking at her, teeth showing. At the very end, Gomez pulled Virgil and Stryker in front of the cameras and said, "We'd particularly like to thank Sheriff James Stryker, who, as you can see, was mildly wounded while suppressing the fire from the farmhouse, and Virgil Flowers, of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, who risked his own life to save the lives of two of our wounded men. Damnedest thing I ever saw. When Virgil backed that truck out of the yard. These are two good guys." Virgil was genuinely embarrassed, but the media were happy, given local heroes in what otherwise might have been interpreted as a fuck-up, with 6 or 7 people dead and 5 in the hospital. After the briefing, the questions started, a few of them hostile, but Gomez was a pro. He turned the hostility back on the questioners, pointing out that they'd seized enough meth to save several hundred lives, including that of young men and women. Methamphetamine is one of the drugs of choice in our public schools. Williamson had one question for Virgil. "Is this the end of the murder epidemic in Blue Stem? Were the Gleasons, the Schmitz, Bill Judd Sr., were they all killed by Fur and his men? And what was the connection?"
"I'd like to answer that question, but I can't, because I don't know the answer," Virgil said. "As far as I'm concerned, the investigation continues."
Davenport called on Virgil's cell as he was shouldering his way out of the press conference.
"You did good," Davenport said. "Now, when are you going to collect the nut job?"
Jesse and Joan were waiting on the sidewalk outside, along with Laura Stryker and a dozen people from the town. Joan said, "What the heck were you guys doing out there?"
Stryker snapped at her. "Our job. I'm the sheriff of this county. They didn't hire me to catch a bunch of dogs."
There was a murmur of approval from the crowd, and Joan said, fists on her hips, "So now there are dead people everywhere, and you've got blood all over you." Jesse was as angry as Joan, and it occurred to Virgil that they'd make good sisters-in-law. Virgil said, "I've got to go," and he walked past them out to his truck, did a U-turn, and drove over to the hospital. A couple of sheriff's cars were still parked outside the emergency entrance, cops on the lookout for any further trouble. Inside, Pirelli was out of it, sound asleep, one arm and shoulder encased in fiberglass, one leg bandaged and elevated. A DEA guy in the hall said, "Virgil." And Virgil asked, "How are they?" "Hanging in there, I think. Doug made it this far. I think he's going to hold on." "Praying for them," Virgil said, though he wasn't, because he didn't think prayer would help. He went back to the motel. Joan was coming down the hall from the direction of his room, saw him and asked, "Are you pissed at me?" "Mildly," he said. "I don't need to take any shit about what happened today, either to Jim or me or even the dead guys. It just happened. It's nobody's fault but Furr's, and he paid for it." "We were scared," she said. "That's okay. I don't want to hear about it. Tomorrow, you can tell me all about being scared." She touched his hair with the matted blood. "I could wash your hair out for you. That's going to hurt." "You could do that," he said. They snuggled up on the bed. No sex, just snuggling. Virgil full of Aleve, his hair wet, and she said, "In the press conference, when you said you didn't know if the killing was all done, what you meant was, it isn't." "I don't think so. In fact..."
"What?"
"We're looking for Bill Judd Jr. Got watches out for him, but seems to be gone. The thing is, I think he might be dead." She rolled up on her elbow. "You still think Williamson?" "The Williamson thing freaks me out. When we braced him, I sort of bought it. He seemed as freaked out as I was when I figured it out. He was screaming at us."
"So?"
"So I don't know. If you pointed a gun at my head and told me to spit out a name, I'd spit out his. You think a guy, he's in the cities, he's a newspaper man, wouldn't he know who his real mother was? Just do a search? He says he didn't. He didn't care who she was. And I guess even if he did, he wouldn't necessarily know that Judd was his father. If he'd ever gone for a birth certificate to get a passport or something." Virgil rolled over on his back, felt the skin pulling around the cuts on his scalp and face. "I gotta think about him. What was he talking to Jesse about? I saw you guys together in the back of the room." "Well, he started out by shaking her hand, saying, 'Long-lost sister.' And then he started pushing her around. Where was she last week? When did she really find out she was Judd's daughter? Where was her mother?" "Like he thought she might be involved?" "He was unpleasant," Joan said. "But he's never been a real pleasant man." "I keep trying to think. Who else?" Sleep pulled him under. He woke up at 2 o'clock and Joan was gone. Went to the bathroom and then back to the bed. Went under again, thinking, "Who else?" Nobody had said a thing about the 357. Of course, Jesse wouldn't, but he didn't think that Jesse was the killer, because that would be aesthetically incongruent. She was just too good-looking. He smiled and mentally wrote his little story, in which the best-looking woman would never be the guilty one. Homer shook his head. The shootout with Furr, the death of Furr, had blocked up a lot of potential information. Brilliant, though, the way Stryker had picked up that seam in the hillside. Homer would never have seen it. And thank God for Stryker's reflexes. He cut Furr down before he had a chance to open up on Homer himself. Anyway, Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria got his ass shot in Sarajevo in 1914, touching off World War I. His wife was killed at the same time. A little less than 90 years later, a bunch of guys in Scotland formed a band called Franz Ferdinand, which was why Virgil was pulling a Franz Ferdinand t-shirt over his head the next morning at 7 o'clock. Find out what happened to the DEA guys. He stopped at a gas station across the street from the motel and bought a moon pie and a Coke. Sugar, fat, and caffeine. The breakfast of champions. Pirelli was awake in a standard room. Gomez asleep on a couch under a window. Virgil asked, "How you doing?" Pirelli said, "I'm hurting," he said. "Oh, God." "How are your guys?" "Both still alive," Pirelli reached out his good hand and knocked on the wood-grained plastic of the bedside table.
I think. I hope.
What about Harmon?
I talked to his wife last night, Pirelli said. She's coming out today.
I don't want to be there, Virgil said.
Neither do I.
They both looked into a corner for a moment, and then Virgil asked, Was it worth it?
If you'd had a good idea, somebody was going to be killed?
Fuck no, it wasn't worth it. Pirelli shook his head.
Don't tell anybody I said that. If I'd known what was going to happen, I'd have set up 500 yards away and hosed down Franks and his trucks in the house and killed the whole bunch of them. But I didn't know.
So what's next for you?
Pirelli shrugged.
Media today.
Docs say I'm going to be out of work for 6 months or so. Then back to Chicago. Try to figure out why we're all of a sudden rolling in heroin down in Gary.
Same old, same old.
Nobody's pissed at you?
Pirelli shook his head.
DEA guys get killed. It's not like the FBI.
Stryker came in.
Morning, Bright Eyes, he said to Pirelli.
Gomez sat up on the couch, shaking his head, smacking his lips. Stryker said,
Talked to the doc 1 minute ago. Things aren't looking too bad, but they're going to move you all to Rochester today. Mayo.
I don't think I need the Mayo, Pirelli started.
They say you're going to need some reconstruction on that shoulder, Stryker said.
A couple of pins.
Might as well get the best.
They talked for a while. A DEA team was flying in from Washington to reconstruct the fight and the house and do an after-action report. The South Dakota ethanol plant had been taken down without a fight. Most of the plant was legit. The lab was not. It was a clean, efficient meth production line. There was a national stop and hold on Bill Judd Jr. They were talking about that when Stryker took a call, listened for a minute, then said,
5 minutes.
And to Pirelli, Gomez, and Virgil,
Bill Judd. He's dead. Up at his old man's place.
Stryker and Virgil went together in a county truck. Gomez and another agent followed in one of the blacked-out DEA trucks, out to the main drag, out of town, and up the hill to the Buffalo Ridge Park entrance, through the park gate, and up the driveway to Judd's. Four sheriff's cars were parked by the burned-out basement. One deputy leaning on his car, talking on his radio. Four more deputies standing in the high grass, north of the house, near the crest of the hill. Virgil and Stryker hopped out of the truck, and Stryker raised a hand to the deputy at the car, and then they led Gomez and the other agent through the grass up the hill.
Hell of a thing, Big Curly said as they came up.
What happened to him?
The crows were here, but it looks like something cracked his skull open. His brains. Take a look.
Judd was on his back, wearing a suit and dress shoes. He didn't have sightless eyes staring at the sun, because he no longer had any eyes. Crows. The top of his head was misshapen, not as though he were shot, but more as though his skull had been crushed. Flattened.
Piece of rebar over there, one of the deputies said. We're waiting for Margot to come up, but it's got blood on it and some hair.
Virgil and Stryker went over and looked. A piece of rusty steel that might have been picked out of the burned house.
That would have done it.
No gunshot wounds.
We know one thing, Little Curly said. It wasn't suicide.
Gomez asked,
What do you think, fur?
We need a time of death, but I don't think so.
It's my other guy, Virgil said.
Gomez grimaced, did a slow 360, looking at the prairie land stretched out around him forever, said,
Interesting little culture you got going here.
Gotta be fur, Stryker said.
Gleason's, Schmidt's, the Judd's, it's a fur cleanup operation. They were gonna get out. They weren't gonna leave anything behind.
I don't know, Virgil said.
Another deputy's car pulled in below them, and Margot Carr got out, took a gear bag out of the trunk, and trudged up the hill.
Another one, she said heavily.
Last one,
but maybe one, Virgil said.
What does that mean?
Stryker asked.
Virgil shrugged.
Down the hill, another truck pulled in, and Todd Williamson got out. The deputy at the truck put a hand out to him, but Williamson jogged straight past him, beat the deputy to the edge of the heavy grass, and pulled away, the deputy still yelling at him. Big Curly blocked him.
You can't be here.
Screw that, Williamson said. He poked a finger at Virgil. If the genius here is right, I'm next of kin. So what happened to my brother? Virgil headed back to the motel, with one stop at the accountant's office. Olafson had just gotten up. She raised the shade on her office door, cocked an eyebrow at Virgil, and opened the door. Virgil stepped inside and asked, If something happened to Bill Judd Jr., would that change what happens with his father's estate?
Is he dead?
She asked.
Pretty much, Virgil said. He told her about it, and she shook her head and said, May the good Lord keep him.
Estate?
Olafson made a noise, then said, I'd have to look up the law, and you might even have to get a special ruling. But you know what? I think it's possible that Jesse Lehman and Todd Williamson, if they can prove a blood connection to Senior, could stand to get a bigger piece of the estate.
The argument would be complicated, she said, and hung on what the IRS would do about Junior's debt, how it would be counted against the estate.
And with this nutcake running around killing everybody, I'm not sure I'd hang around to make the argument.
Virgil thanked her and continued on to the motel. Shut down his cell phone, took off his boots, put the chain on the door, stretched out on the bed. There'd been a thread running through this thing, he thought, right up to the firefight at first place. If only he could find one end of it and pull it.
Chapter 21 Virgil rolled off the bed, looked at the clock. He'd been down an hour. Brushed his teeth and stood in the shower. At the end of a case, when the facts were piling up, a nap often worked to clarify his thoughts. Instead of being scattered around like crumbs, they tended to clump together. And that had happened. About fur. Jim Stryker was at least partly correct. When Virgil thought about it, it seemed unlikely that a town the size of Bluestem would be home to two separate but simultaneous very large crimes. Yet Fur had denied the connection, even when it wouldn't make any difference to him. Could he have been protecting someone else? Seemed unlikely. Seemed unlikely that in Bluestem he could have had an unknown relationship so close that he would die protecting it, that he would swear on a Bible. About the other suspects, Stryker, now, or some other cop, the Curleys, or the Merrill guy, or even Jensen or Carr, or one of the Laymans, or Williamson. Did he, Virgil, have a perceptual problem? Did he come to town and view certain people as suspects because those were the only people he saw or spoke to or heard about? He'd gotten all over Williamson. Had he been conditioned to do that because Joan had mentioned Williamson's name the first time he met her? He thought about it and decided, no, that might have been the case, except for the revelation. The Book of Revelation at the Gleasons. The cigarette butt at the Schmitz. The anonymous note. And the corporate evidence on Judd's secretary's computer. All had pointed him at Fur. Or Judd and Fur together. He was being pushed at somebody. A passing thought. Bill Judd's secretary. Who was she? The evidence for the Judd-Fur connection came right out of her computer. He'd heard her name, but didn't remember it. More ideas. Could he clear anyone? If he could clear Stryker or Williamson, or the Curleys, the Laymans, or the Judds, then he'd know something. Other suspects would come into sharper focus. Was Joan a suspect? She'd gotten close to him by noon on his first day in town. How about Jesse Lehman, or her mother Margaret? How long had they really been waiting for Judd to die? Also, in one way or another, the killer of the Gleasons and the Schmitz, and probably the Judds, had been in Jesse Lehman's closet. Stryker had been there, he thought. Who else? Technically her mother, but
Her mother wouldn't be framing Jesse, at least not for any reason that Virgil knew of. There was the additional problem that the layman's house could be entered by any teenager with a stick. Virgil got his gun, clipped it under his jacket, put on his straw hat, and called Stryker. When we were in Judd's office, looking at the secretary's computer, what was her name again?
Amy Sweet. You think we ought to talk to her?
No need to bother you. I might stop by and have a chat, Virgil said. Sort of at loose ends is what I am. Can't get over Junior getting hit like that.
Yeah. Still think it was fur. You still think it wasn't?
I've moved a few inches in your direction, Virgil said. But keep your ass down anyway. Amy Sweet was another middle-aged woman who might have been a rocker at one time. Too heavy now, round-shouldered, wrapped in a housecoat with pink curlers in her hair. I'd be happy to talk to you, she said at the door of her small home, but I've got to be in Sioux Falls for a job interview at 1 o'clock.
Take a couple of minutes, Virgil said.
What was all the excitement a while ago?
She pushed her face toward him, squinting, nearsighted.
There's been another murder.
Oh, no.
She stepped across the room, fumbled around on a TV tray, found steel-rimmed glasses, and put them on.
Who?
Bill Judd, Jr.
Oh, no.
Round, Swedish O's.
Miss Sweet, when we were going through Judd Sr.'s office, we found some invoices on your computer for chemicals that were apparently used in an ethanol plant out in South Dakota.
I heard about it on TV. That was the same one? The one where they were making drugs?
Yes, it was, Virgil said.
Oh, no.
The sound was driving him crazy. She sounded like a bad comedian.
Who in town knew about the ethanol plant?
She turned her face to one side and put a hand to her lips.
Well, the Judds, of course.
Both of them? Virgil asked.
Well, Junior set it up, but Senior knew about it.
He pressed. Are you sure about that?
Well, yes, he signed the checks.
Did you see him signing the checks? Virgil asked.
No, but I saw the checks. It was his signature.
Do you remember the bank?
She shook her head. No, I don't.
She frowned. I'm not even sure that the bank name was on the checks.
Did you ever talk to Junior about that?
No, it wasn't my business, she said.
They wanted to keep it quiet because, you know, when ethanol started, it sounded a little like the Jerusalem artichoke thing. The Judds were involved in that, of course.
So how quiet did they keep it? Virgil asked. Who else knew? Did you tell anybody?
He saw it coming, the no. Oh, no. Junior told me, don't talk about this because of my father. So I didn't.
Not to anybody?
Her eyes drifted. She was thinking, which meant that she had. It's possible. My sister, I might have told. I think there might have been some word around town.
It's really important that you remember.
She put her hand to her temple, as though she were going to move a paperclip with telekinesis, and said, I might have mentioned it at bridge, at our bridge club, that a plant was being built and some local people were involved.
All right, Virgil said. So who was at the bridge club?
Well, let me see, there would have been 9 or 10 of us.
She listed them. He only recognized one of the names.
When he was done with Sweet, he strolled up the hill to the newspaper office. He pushed in and found Williamson behind the business counter, talking to a woman customer. Williamson looked past the woman and snapped, What do you want?
I have a question when you're free.
Wait. Williamson was wearing a T-shirt and had sweat stains under his arms, as though he'd been lifting rocks.
Take just a minute.
The customer was trying to dump her Beanie Baby collection locally, 10 years too late, in Virgil's opinion, and wanted the cheapest possible advertisement. She got 20 words for $6. Looking back and forth between Virgil and Williamson, and after writing a check for the amount, said to Virgil,
I'd love to hear your question.
Virgil looked at her over his sunglasses and grinned.
I'd love to have you, but I'm afraid it's got to be private for the moment.
Shoot.
She looked at Williamson, who shrugged, and she said, Oh, well. When she'd gone out the door, Williamson said, I'm working. You can ask me out back.
You still pissed about the search?
Goddamn right, wouldn't you be?
Virgil followed him through the shop. Williamson's van was parked in the dirt space behind it, the side doors open. Williamson had been piling bundles of unsold newspapers in the van, and there were still 20 or 30 wrapped bundles inside the shop. Williamson propped the door open, picked up 2 bundles by the plastic straps, carried them to the van, and asked over his shoulder,
What?
Virgil grabbed a couple of bundles, carried them out, and threw them in the van.
When did you last see Junior?
About 1.5 hours ago.
Alive.
They were shuttling back and forth with the bundles. Williamson stopped and cocked his head.
Day before yesterday.
Let's see, down at Johnny's at lunch.
Did you hear him next door yesterday?
Virgil asked, heaving 2 more bundles into the van.
No, he wasn't there. I stopped. I wanted to ask him where I should send the money we've got coming in. His office was locked.
What time was that?
First time around 9 o'clock, right after I got here. Then when the shooting started out at Furs, I heard about it from a cop, and I took off, headed down there to Furs, but the cops had all the roads blocked. Before I took off, I ran next door. I was going to tell Bill about it.
Why?
Williamson shrugged. I don't know. Big news, maybe something to do with his old man.
All right, Virgil said. He threw 2 more bundles in the van, leaving 3 in the shop.
So he wasn't here all day yesterday, and wasn't here last night?
Nope,
and I was here late.
Virgil nodded. If Judd had disappeared some hours before the fight at Furs, that meant that both Stryker and Fur, or one of Fur's men, could have killed him.
Then Williamson stacked the 3 remaining bundles, one on top of the other, and stooped to pick them up. As he did it, his t-shirt sleeve hiked up, exposing a tattoo of a crescent moon. The moon with a slash for an eye and a pointed nose. A man in the moon. The tattoo was rough, with bleeding edges. Dark ink from a ballpoint pen. Virgil blinked. Another man in the moon.
Son of a bitch.
He left Williamson with the van, walked back to his truck, got on the phone to Joan.
What are you doing? He asked.
Headed over to Worthington to do some federal bureaucratic bullshit about crop insurance. What about you?
I'm headed up to the cities, Virgil said. Could be overnight.
I'd love to come, she said, but this appointment in Worthington is not optional. If I want to stay in business, I've got everything in quintuplicate, and they want it today.
Okay, see you tomorrow then.
She laughed at the tone. I'll brace myself. He called the Laymans, but nobody answered. Called Stryker and asked if he had Jesse's cell phone. He got the number and said to Stryker, I'm running up to the cities, back tomorrow.
Anything good?
Just some federal bureaucratic bullshit.
How's the election looking?
Folks are smiling at me, Stryker said. I'm golden for at least a week, and as long as you're wrong about Fur. If somebody else gets killed now that Fur's gone, I'm back in the toilet.
Virgil called Jesse. She answered after a couple of rings.
Virgil!
Jesse, listen, I'm going to the cities. It's really important that you and your mom get someplace safe. Don't get alone with any third person, no matter whether you know him or not. Maybe go over to Worthington or Sioux Falls. Check into a motel. Just overnight. I should be back tomorrow.
You think somebody's looking for us? She asked.
It's possible. I don't want to take any chances. Get yourself undercover until tomorrow.
Mom's at work, she said.
Pick her up, Virgil said. Keep her away from the house.
I was planning to go out tonight,
Jesse, just for the heck of it.
Let's say you should stay away from Jim Stryker, too.
Jim?
Just for the heck of it, until I get back.
He swung by the motel, picked up a bag, headed out on the highway. As soon as he was clear of town, he turned on the flashers and dropped the hammer. Got settled online and called Davenport. He wasn't in the office, but he got him on the cell phone. Can I borrow Sandy or Jenkins or Shrake for a few hours?
Jenkins and Shrake are picking a guy up, Davenport said. Sandy's working on something, but if it's important, I'm cracking this thing, Virgil said. I need some names and some record checks.
She'll call you back.
Virgil remembered Joan's mother, Laura, talking about grandmothers, about how she wanted to be one, about how she wanted to watch her grandchildren grow up, about how she had time to see great-grandchildren. Laura Stryker wasn't that old, a baby boomer, in fact, a rock and roller, the same age as Williamson's mother. Williamson's mother might have been dead, but it was possible that his natural grandparents were still alive. And grandparents do take an interest. Normal ones, anyway. So there might be, Virgil thought, somebody in the cities who'd taken a lifelong interest in Todd Williamson. Had to be Williamson, Virgil thought. Judd Sr.'s sister-in-law, Betsy Carlson, in wandering in and out of rationality, had mentioned the man in the moon. Virgil had connected that to the man on the moon party at Judd's. But Betsy had been right. She said she'd seen the man in the moon. She'd talked to Williamson at some point. Had seen Judd within him. And had seen the tattoo, which brought everything back. And Williamson would have no reason to talk to Betsy Carlson unless he knew that Judd was his father. New fact. When he and Stryker checked Williamson's police record, they'd found nothing at all. But the tattoo on Williamson's arm hadn't come from a tattoo parlor. It was a prison tattoo, done with a sewing needle and ballpoint pen ink. Maybe he'd gotten it on the outside from somebody who'd been inside, knew how to do it. Maybe he chose a crude tattoo for aesthetic reasons. But Virgil was willing to bet that Williamson had been inside, at least for a while. So why didn't Virgil know that? Why hadn't a record popped up? He could think of one good reason. He looked down at the speedometer, 101. He called the highway patrol and marshal again and cleared the way out front. Got off the phone, then got back on when the cell burped. Sandy. Sandy, I want you to find Todd Williamson's adoptive parents. Search every database you can find. Look at their taxes. Find out when they stopped paying them. Then check all the surrounding states, in Florida, California, and Arizona. See if you can find them. Call old neighbors if you have to.
I can do that, she said.
Then, check Margaret Lane, died 7-20-69. See if you can find a birth certificate. Find out if her parents are still alive. This would be Todd Williamson's grandparents. Then check the NCIC for Elaine, unknown first name, born 7-20-69.
You think he used his mother's name? Sandy asked.
If he got a birth certificate, he could use it to get a driver's license, and he could use that to get a social security number. He could do the same thing with his adoptive parents' names. Have two perfectly good IDs based on official state documents.
How soon do you need it?
I'm on my way up there, 100 miles an hour, Virgil said. Feed it to me as you get it. If you find people, route me to their locations.
When he got off, he looked down at the speedometer. 105. He'd always liked speed, but the truck was squealing like a pig. Sandy called back as he was making the turn north on I-35. The NCIC has a William Lane, 7-20-69, showing arrests in 87 and twice in 88, possession of a small amount of cocaine on the first one, and then two assault charges in 88, apparently a domestic thing. He spent 4 months in the Hennepin County Jail on the second assault. Let me look. Blah, blah, blah. A Karen Biggs. I'll see if I can find her. Email it to me. She called 15 minutes later. I've got the Biggs woman. She lives in Cottage Grove now. Her name is Johansson. Got a bunch of DWIs. I checked William Lane. He shared an address with Todd Williamson in 88 and 89.
Got him, Virgil said.
Yep. Haven't found his parents yet. They left too long ago, Sandy said.
Keep looking. How about the grandmother? Virgil asked.
Ralph and Helen Lane. Ralph died a long time ago. Helen is still alive. She lives up in Roseville, but I haven't been able to reach her.
Give me those addresses.
He propped his notebook in the center of the steering wheel, kept one eye half-cocked toward the highway, took the addresses down. 10 minutes after that, Sandy was back. The Williamsons are in Arizona. I've got an address, but no phone number. I'll try to get one.
Good. If you have to, check on neighbors. Have them go next door and find out the number.
Okay. I'm looking at license photos on Williamson and Lane, and they are indeed the same person, though Lane has some facial hair and an earring, Sandy said.
Email him.
He got off the phone, stayed on the accelerator, took a call from Davenport as he swung onto I-35 east, south of the cities. I talked to Sandy. She says you're rolling on this thing.
I think so.
You got anything for a trial? Davenport asked.
Gotta think about trial.
Not yet. Gonna have to think of something cute to get that. Right now I'm trying to nail down the fact that my guy's a psycho.
All right, stay in touch.
He came off I-35 east, cut east across the south end of the cities on I-494, and then south on Highway 61, the same one that Bob Dylan revisited, heading into Cottage Grove. Off at 80th Street, he called Sandy, who got on MapQuest and took him straight into Johansson's place. Johansson's son came to the door, wearing wrapper jeans with a crotch at knee level and a T-shirt that was 4 sizes too big. He had a Game Boy in his hand. His eyes were at half-mast, and the odor of marijuana floated out of the house when he opened the door.
"She's at work," he said sullenly.
"Where?"
"Either Super America or Tom Thumb. She works at both of them," he said. "I don't know where she's working today."
Karen Johansson was at the Super America, throwing expired donuts in a dumpster. "I have some questions about William Lane, who was convicted of assaulting you," Virgil said, flashing his ID.
"Shoot, that was 20 years ago almost. She was a short, broad woman with black hair and watery brown eyes, a pushed-in nose, older-looking than her years."
"I know that," Virgil said. "What we're trying to do is, we're trying to get a grip on what kind of a guy he is. The assaults, were they heavy duty or just sort of routine domestic fighting?"
"He was trying to kill me," Johansson said, matter-of-factly.
She waved her hand in front of her face like a fan. They were too close to the dumpster, which smelled of spoiled bananas and meat and sour milk.
"He would have, too, if he'd been stronger. The first time he was hitting me with a chair, and he couldn't get a good swing, and I was running around, so he never did hit me square. The neighbors called the cops. There was a car in the neighborhood, and they got there in time. But he would have killed me."
"What set it off?" Virgil asked.
"Basically, we were drinking and started arguing," she said. "I was working and he wasn't, and I told him he was a worthless piece of shit who couldn't even pay the rent, and he punched my arm, and I hit him with my purse and knocked him down, and he just went off, completely out of control."
"What about the second time?" Virgil asked, "when he went to jail?"
"That time he choked the shit out of me," she said. Her hand went to her neck as she remembered. "He came home drunk. I was asleep. He woke me up and wanted, you know, and I didn't want to. He started screaming at me, and I wised off, and he jumped on me and choked me. He had some friends with him, out in the living room, and they heard the fight. One of his friends pulled me off, and then I wasn't breathing so good. So the girlfriend of the friend called the cops, and they called an ambulance, and they started me breathing again."
"That was all for the two of you?"
"Yeah. When he was in jail, I moved. Changed my address and got an unlisted phone. But I saw him anyway. We had some of the same friends. But we were all done, and he didn't come around anymore," Johansson said. "Good thing, too. He would have killed me, sooner or later."
"Did he ever mention his parents?" Virgil asked.
"Said his mom was killed in a car wreck," she said. "Didn't say who his dad was."
"What about his adoptive parents, some people named Williamson?"
She shook her head. "Oh, I thought they were his foster care people or something. They adopted him?"
"Yes, when he was a baby."
"Jeez, I didn't know that," she said. "That makes it worse."
"Worse?"
"Yeah, I met them 2 or 3 times, I guess, going over there with Bill. We used to go over there for beer. He had a key. But they were like total assholes."
"Yeah?"
"Yeah,
like they believed in slavery, she said. They used to tell him about how much he owed them, in money. Bill ran away when he was 14. He was living on the street when I met him. He ran away because they wanted him to work in their store all the time. They called it earning his keep. But most kids who are 13 or 14 don't have to work 60 hours a week. That's what they wanted. No kidding, they were assholes.
Did Bill ever call himself Todd Williamson?
She shook her head.
Nope, he was Lane to all of us guys. The people he hung around with.
Good guy? Bad guy? Virgil asked. I mean, when he was sober?
Not bad when he was sober, Johansson said.
She looked at her thumb. It had frosting on it, and she wiped it on the dumpster.
Bad when he was drunk.
But that was 20 years ago. He was a teenager.
You work in this store, you realize that a lot of teenagers are assholes, and a lot of them change when they get older.
Think Bill would change?
She shrugged. I don't know. He was like a dog that you beat for 10 years. Not the dog's fault if he goes crazy.
Sandy called. I got the grandmother. She's home. I told her to stay there.
Call her back. Tell her I'll be there in half an hour, Virgil said.
He said goodbye to Johansson and headed north, 20 minutes to an inner-ring suburban neighborhood. Green lawns, cracked driveways, older ranch-style and split-level homes. Two long-haired teenagers doing intricate and athletic bike tricks. Helen Lane, Williamson's natural grandmother, was alone in her living room, watching television, when Virgil pulled into the driveway. She came to the door, kept the screen locked.
I don't know where Todd is. I don't want to know. He was in jail for a while.
Did he do something else?
Did he give you a hard time? Virgil asked.
He'd steal money from me. He'd sneak into the house and steal, she said.
How did he find out you were his grandmother? Virgil asked.
He was smart. Got his brains from my daughter, she said.
I guess the Williamsons had a paper, maybe his birth certificate.
Did he ever figure out who his real father was?
She frowned and said, none of us knew who it was. I don't think Maggie knew for sure. She was running wild.
You never knew?
No. And after she died, there was no way to find out. Sure as heck weren't no men coming around to ask about it.
And the baby?
Was adopted. We didn't have any money. My husband was sick all the time. He was a roofer. He hurt his back, she said, sorry for herself. I was working all the time, so it seemed like the best thing to do was to let the baby go.
Yeah?
Yeah. You know, to a good family.
Chapter 22 Virgil grabbed a McDonald's meal on the way back to Bluestem, 10 minutes off the highway and back on, the car smelling like quarter-pounders with cheese and fries, driving into the dying light, thinking as he drove that Williamson's past had not been quite what he'd expected. You could take the mad dog view of things, that Williamson was nuts, driven that way by parental neglect and possibly actual abuse, and that as sorry a tale as that might be, a mad dog is still a mad dog. You could just as easily take another view. Orphaned kid, abused by adoptive parents, pushed onto the streets when he was still a kid, and somehow he rights himself, goes in the army, learns a trade, and becomes a respectable citizen. Virgil, who basically had a kindly heart, preferred the second story. But his cop brain said, a mad dog is still a mad dog, even if it's not the dog's fault. He was in Bluestem a little before 11 o'clock. Larry Jensen's house was lit up like a Christmas tree, and when he got out of the truck on the driveway, Virgil could feel an impact through his feet, as though somebody were shooting a big gun in Jensen's basement, but not quite like a gun. He rang the bell, and a moment later Jensen's wife came to the door. She was a small woman, sweaty, very pregnant. She turned on the porch light, and Virgil felt the impact again, whatever it was. She peered out through the window in the door, then opened it and said, "You're Virgil."
"Yes. Is Larry here?"
"He's down breaking up the basement," she said. "What's going on?"
Jensen was breaking up the basement floor with a sledgehammer, working bare-chested. The basement had been finished sometime long before,
and now the walls had been stripped of the sheetrock, showing the bare studs and long streaks of old PL-200, with chunks of drywall still stuck to it. Virgil came down the steps just as Jensen came through a swing, the hammer cracking into the concrete. And then he turned, and his eyes narrowed when he saw Virgil. He wiped his head and asked, "What's up?" "Putting in a toilet, huh? Gonna have one more kid," he said, propping the hammer against the basement wall. "That'll be 3 girls and a boy, and we sure as shit won't get along with one bathroom. So what are you doing?" "Gotta ask you a question, Larry. If Stryker's popularity takes a fall, are you running for sheriff?" Jensen looked at him for a moment. "Why would you want to know?" "Larry, believe me, just answer the question, okay?" Jensen wiped his forehead with the palm of his hand, wiped his hand on his jeans, and said, "Nah, I'm happy like I am. I'll get my 25 when I'm 45, and then maybe try something new, double dip." "The power doesn't appeal to you," Virgil said. Jensen shook his head. "What are you up to, Virgil? And no, it doesn't appeal to me. Come on, get your jacket. We gotta make a call." "It's midnight, Virgil. Does Jim know about this?" "Get your jacket, Larry. We gotta make a call, and I'm not going alone. I need a witness. And Margot Carr, call her up too. Jim doesn't know about it, because it would embarrass him to know about it, officially." Jensen put his hands on his hips. "Well, shit. Larry..." They got a key from the evidence locker and rode out to the Schmidt house in silence. "This worries me. I really don't like it," Jensen said. "I don't like it either," Virgil said. The Schmidt house was dark and silent, an air of gloom gripping it like a glove. They parked under the yard light, and Jensen led the way across the yard, choked. "You're not afraid of ghosts, are you?" "No, not that I'd mess around with one if I had the chance," Virgil said. Inside, they brought the computer up. Virgil went to the inbox, checked Schmidt's email. The letters from the Curleys were gone, as Virgil thought they would be. "Doesn't necessarily mean a lot," Jensen said. "No, it doesn't. It can't be entirely innocent, but it might not be entirely guilty either. Just trying to keep their asses out of the fire," Virgil said. A set of headlights swept the yard, and a minute later Margot Carr knocked, then stepped inside. "What have you got?" "I need you to take this computer to your place. Not the office. To your place. And lock it up," Virgil said. "Then tomorrow, I want you to get in touch with the state crime lab about recovering files on the hard drive. Should be simple enough. Don't have to do it yet, but make the arrangements." She looked from Virgil to Jensen and back again. "What are we looking for?" "Roman Schmidt's emails," Virgil said. "All of them." He met Stryker and Jensen again at 9 o'clock the next morning at the sheriff's office, Virgil carrying a cup of coffee. "Where's Merrill?" "He's on his way," Stryker said. "Larry's filled me in. I think you probably ought to do this somewhere else. You could use a courtroom." Virgil nodded, then said, "What about the guys from the DEA? They holding on?" Stryker nodded. "All holding on. I talked to Pirelli this morning." "What exactly are you doing, Virgil? You never told Larry exactly what..." "Talk to you in a bit," Virgil said. "Send Merrill over when he shows up." To Jensen, "Let's go nail down that courtroom." The courtroom was empty, and Virgil walked back and turned the latch between the courtroom and the judge's chamber. He asked Jensen, "When are you going to get that basement finished?" Virgil asked. "Virgil, I'm not up for any small talk right now," Jensen said. "These guys are friends of mine." Virgil said, "Don't worry about it. If they did do something wrong, we can always cover it up." That made Jensen laugh, once. Then he shook his head and said, "I'll remember that. You know when they have me on the witness stand and they're putting the screws on my thumbs?" "Listen," Virgil said, "does anybody in town teach CPR? You know where you practice on one of those dummies?" Jensen was confused. "Yeah, the fire guys do that. They go around to the schools." "Why?" "Small talk. Just keeping you occupied," Virgil said. They heard footfalls outside the courtroom, and Virgil lowered his voice. "Here comes one now." Merrill came in, looked at Virgil, and said to Jensen, "You called?"
Virgil said. When you talked to me in the men's room about Jesse Lehman and her car not being there at the Judd fire, where were you?
I didn't see you there.
I was up the hill trying to keep people from doing an end run to the fire. I saw you go by.
So you said you didn't see Jesse's truck. Did you look at all the trucks?
No.
Then why pick on Jesse? Virgil asked.
Merrill hooked his thumbs over his gun belt, which in a cop is defensive.
I heard talk that nobody had seen her, and since I hadn't either, I thought you should know.
Who'd you hear that talk from? Virgil asked.
Merrill's eyes went to Jensen.
What's going on, Larry?
Not a big deal, Jensen said. We're just trying to track down where you might have heard that.
It's sort of confidential.
It's not confidential from us, Virgil said. His voice was mild and quiet, so Merrill had to concentrate on him.
If I need to immunize you and put you in front of a grand jury to get it, I'll do that. Of course, you'll lose your job. If there are any subsidiary entanglements, you could be going to Stillwater for a few years.
What are you talking about? Merrill barked. I was giving you a tip.
Virgil looked at Jensen.
Better read him his rights. Do we have to do that with police officers?
I think maybe we should.
Merrill said, What the hell?
Virgil said, We really need to know where you heard that. That's all. No crime at this point. Could get to be a crime, depending.
So where did you hear it?
Merrill looked at Jensen, then back at Virgil.
Jesus. I mean, it's no big deal, I guess.
I heard it from Little Curly.
Virgil smiled.
See, that was easy enough. We thought you probably had. So take off. Keep this to yourself. And I mean, deputy, keep it to yourself. We're right in the middle of a complicated thing here, and you best keep your head down.
The Curlys came in together.
Jensen had called Little Curly, told him to find his father, bring him in. Little Curly was wearing his uniform. Big Curly was off duty, wearing red shorts and a t-shirt that showed off his gut.
Sit down, Virgil said.
They sat, and Big Curly asked Jensen, What's going on, Larry?
Virgil said, You're talking to me, not to Larry. He's more of a witness.
Big Curly looked at his son, then asked Virgil,
What the hell are you talking about?
I need to set some quick ground rules, Virgil said. You don't have to talk to me. If you don't, then the chips fall where they may. One or both of you have done things that helped out the killer of the Gleasons and the Schmidts and the Judds.
What? That's bullshit,
Big Curly said. He looked at his son, shook his head, then said to Jensen,
Larry, are you putting up with this shit?
Jensen said, You should listen to him. Virgil continued, Whether you knew it or not, but if you bail on me now, like I said, a prosecutor could take a fairly harsh view of it, or we can handle it privately, and maybe, if I think it was all innocent, we let it go, though I'll have to talk to Jim about it.
Little Curly, I still don't know what you're talking about.
Virgil asked, Who went into the Schmidt's house and erased emails from Roman Schmidt's computer? The Curlys looked at each other. Then Big Curly, his face gone grim, said,
I did. But it had nothing to do with the killings. It was a personal matter.
I know, about the election, Virgil said. We've got the computer sequestered, and we can recover the emails if we need to. Keep that in mind. Now, did you walk anybody through the house after the killings?
Little Curly shook his head.
Not me. Why would I?
Big Curly said,
Me neither.
How about the Gleason's house, after the murder?
Little Curly shook his head, but Big Curly hung his, groaned, and said,
That fucking Williamson.
Why? Virgil asked.
Because of the election, Big Curly said, looking up at Virgil. His eyes were wet, as though he were about to start crying. I was getting on Todd's good side. The newspaper's about the only way to campaign here that anybody can afford. His articles can set the whole tone of the election, and you don't even have to pay for them. Jim is getting in trouble with these murders. Somebody was going to take the job away from him.
Virgil turned to Little Curly. You had Merrill suggest to me that Jesse Lehman might have had something to do with the killings, that her truck wasn't at the park the night of the Judd fire. It was there. So why'd you suggest that it wasn't? Little Curly shook his head.
I didn't see it. I saw her, but not the truck. I was talking with Todd, and he brought it up.
Did you ever see Todd up there?
The Curlys looked at each other. Then Little Curly said, Well, not actually, I assumed.
Why didn't you tell me yourself, Virgil asked, about Jesse?
Because, oh, shit, because I didn't want to get involved with you. I didn't want to talk to you.
Because of the election? Because Jim was seeing Jesse, and if you tarred Jesse, you'd get Jim, too?
Little Curly shook his head.
Look, Todd said she wasn't there. I didn't see her. We thought you should know.
And smearing Jim was just a side benefit.
Fuck you, Little Curly said. All right, Virgil said. To Big Curly, when you walked Williamson through, was he ever alone for even a minute?
Well, maybe for a few seconds here and there. He'd be looking at one thing, taking some notes. I might be looking at another.
Virgil turned to Jensen. Did Jim give you a hard time about not spotting that book of Revelation?
Jensen shrugged. Not a hard time. He got me and Margo in his office, said we should have seen it. Said it was embarrassing that you picked it up first. Wasn't the most pleasant 5 minutes of my life.
You didn't pick it up because it wasn't there, Virgil said. Williamson planted it when Big Curly walked him through. He was trying to point us at Fur. He did the same thing with that Salem cigarette by the Schmidt stoop. He knew we'd pick it up. I knew that Fur smoked, and I thought they were Salem's. I'm sure it would have come up at some point, if there was ever a question, a trial.
Why? Why would he do all this? Little Curly asked.
Judd's money?
Virgil shook his head.
Nope. Basically, he did it because he's nuts. Nuts, but careful. And he thought he was smart enough that he could get away with it. I don't think he could really help himself.